You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved.
Tonight's show is being underwritten by United Auto Workers Local 249, and International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 124. The United Auto Workers Local members building the best Ford trucks and vans
in the world.
International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, 124, supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We have been wiring Kansas City since 1905, and if you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEW124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, we'll interview 9 to 5's Ellen Bravo and Rethinking School's Larry Miller about their new memoir, a novel with stories from their lives as labor activists. Then, after years of inaction to expand Medicaid by the Missouri legislature, the voters took matters into their own hands and passed it. But it's still a fight to get Medicaid to the people. Sheldon Weisgrau is VP of Health Policy at the Missouri Foundation for Health. He'll explain why it's such a struggle to get health care to hardworking, low-income Missourians. In the news, Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO issues statement on the loss of the federal right to an abortion. And what? Microsoft doesn't want to be a union buster? The other Seattle company, Starbucks, must feel betrayed. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Ario. It's about first, OSHA signs an alliance with Kansas City Electrical Apprenticeship. Second, mine safety targets the new black lung. And what companies need to know about OSHA's new heat illness program. Now for the news. Now for the news from our side, July 7th, 2002. Pat Dujakovic, a.k.a. Duke, has issued a statement on behalf of the Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO in response to the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade. He said, quote, "We have a voice that we must use when an issue arises affecting the working people in this area. But too often, we choose to stay silent on topics that disproportionately impact our sisters, and especially our sisters of color, because there are not enough of them in positions that make the decisions. It's our duty to stand up and say this is wrong. Currently, women in need of treatment to save their lives will have to travel to another state to find the treatment they need. In vitro fertilization looks like it will become illegal, and victims of a violent crime and their families have no say in their future. It's the law, and you did not get to vote on it. There will be an attempt to change it in a couple of years, and you might get to vote on it then. Justice Thomas named the cases that guaranteed the rights to contraception, same-sex relations, and marriage equality, respectively, as appropriate for the court to reconsider, given they relied on similar reasoning. We have a duty to correct the error established in those precedents, Justice Thomas wrote. It's time for the KCAFL-CIO to use our voice and issue the following statement. Being able to work is central to a family's economic well-being. Being able to control pregnancy is, again, key to that family's economic well-being, not just for the union member, but for their families. Please register to vote.
In the wake of the announcement of the winning cities for the 2026 World Cup, The Guardian has the following to say about what it called an improbable victory for Kansas City. KC beat out Montreal, D.C., Baltimore, and Boston. Chicago dropped out of the running because of the cost. When FIFA evaluated the Kansas City bid in 2018, it scored some of the lowest marks for accommodation and transport among the contenders. But the airport's being rebuilt, there's a vibrant soccer culture, the Hunt family is among the most influential dynasties in U.S. sports, and Missouri passed a bill exempting World Cup tickets from sales taxes, unlike Colorado. Host cities will include Kansas City, Vancouver, Canada, Atlanta, Monterrey in Mexico, and a dozen more cities across the continent. Journalist and author Jonathan Wilson wrote in 2014, but really every World Cup now is held in FIFA land, a tax-free generic bubble in which the name of the venue is written on an advertising hoarding by the halfway line, because otherwise there's no way you'd be able to work out where you were. The income growth is staggering. FIFA said that it made a near $100 million surplus at the 1994 tournament, the last to be held in the United States, from revenue of $235 million. When it pitched for the 2026, the North American bid projected $14 billion in revenue and an $11 billion surplus for FIFA. The governing body is literally a law unto itself, insisting that governments agree to provide exemptions from labor law and other legislation, streamline border and work permit processes, and tax exemptions. And so local and state authorities, lavishing public funds and tax breaks on professional sports and citing pie-in-the-sky economic benefits. Multi-billion dollar businesses paying a lower tax rate than the average individual. What could be more American?
Following the recent Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe, American companies, many of which spent millions supporting anti-abortion politicians, have publicly shared their commitment to supporting employees in need of abortions. One of these companies is Starbucks, also known as one of the worst labor law violators in the country. In response to the Roe decision, Starbucks offered employees access to abortion, travel, and gender-affirming care. But they drew the line at guaranteeing this access to their unionized stores.
Meanwhile, in what's called a man bites dog story, Microsoft says it won't oppose employee unionization. While Amazon calls the cops to arrest union organizers and Starbucks fires them, Microsoft is breaking ranks, not just with Amazon and Starbucks, with virtually the entirety of American business, both big and small. It says if employees want to unionize, Microsoft says that's fine. In a June 2nd blog post, Microsoft President Brad Smith wrote the company would not discourage or delay its workers from forming or joining unions. Shortly thereafter, the company made a joint announcement with the Communication Workers of America, the CWA, that if a majority of employees at Activision Blizzard, which Microsoft is in the process of purchasing for $70 billion, signed union affiliation cards, it would recognize that union. It would not oppose that effort. It would not subject the workers to anti-union arguments. It would not insist on a follow-up election. There was leverage. In March, the CWA sent a letter to federal regulators saying that the proposed acquisition by Microsoft of Activision Blizzard raised a host of antitrust considerations. With this week's announcement, however, the union withdrew its complaint. The news was read by the award-winning Judy Ansel, Stephen Hill, and I'm Lincoln Dreher.
Stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition, and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the streets the traffic starts jumping, with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. Barely getting by, it's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. Labor fiction is a tough genre. It's hard not to be too preachy, too theoretical, or just too phony as the author exposes the exploitation of the workplace or the greedy bosses. So it's been a real pleasure to me to read Standing Up, Tales of Struggle by Ellen Bravo and Larry Miller, because their novel is none of those things and contains a lot of useful experience and wisdom. It's a collection of connected stories which smack of memoir, made truer or more engaging as stories. All in all, I think they accomplished what they set out to do, which was to give us as readers, and especially those of us who are activists or want to be activists, a credible and digestible manual for an activist life. And it's filled with pearls of wisdom about organizing. Ellen Bravo was a longtime activist and author who worked with 9 to 5, the National Association of Working Women, for over 20 years and co-founded the Family Values at Work Network, which helps win paid leave and paid sick days policies around the country. Ellen is a recipient of the Ford Foundation Visionary Award. And Larry Miller is a former union member and shop steward with 2 decades of experience in jobs ranging from hospital laundry to steel mills and medical equipment manufacturing. A layoff sent him to college, followed by almost 2 decades in schools as a teacher. For 12 years, he served on the school board of the Milwaukee Public Schools, including 2 terms as president. Larry is an editor of Rethinking Schools, which a number of teachers use for very creative ideas about teaching. The book is called Standing Up, Tales of Struggle. Welcome to both of you, Ellen and Larry, to the Heartland Labor Forum.
So great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so first up, let's get an overview of the places, the types of social struggles, and the differences in workplaces that you cover in the book. Larry, you start off, as the book does, with the character Nick, a 20-year-old white rebel from Milwaukee who goes to Atlanta, presumably to find the tail end of the civil rights movement in 1970, and gets a job in a hospital laundry among all or mostly black workers. Give us the trajectory of Nick's life.
He shows up looking for a job. He was actually wanting to get into heavy industry, but ended up in largest hospital in the South at the time in their laundry. He's the only white worker out of about 50 workers. And they're in the midst of organizing. They're actually in the midst of trying to figure out what to do around horrible working conditions. And he is fortunate enough to be schooled and trained in an atmosphere where grassroots folks are trying to take some power into their own hands. I mean, it was a gift from the heavens for him, because they were more than willing once they could trust him. And he wasn't just there to be trained for, you know, to become a supervisor or a boss, because of course all the bosses were white at that time in 1969. And so Nick's experience went from there to other workplaces and had similar experiences.
Okay. And then goes into teaching.
Yes. Later on in this 50-year span that we cover, Nick ends up in Milwaukee going back to college because he got laid off at General Electric, making x-ray machines, and becomes a teacher, and then becomes active both within the teachers union, but also very active with his students.
Same question to you, Ellen. What about Sophie? She enters the story 4 years after we begin with Nick in Baltimore, where Nick has moved and gotten a job in a steel mill and meets her at some political meeting of, I thought this was hilarious, the Dump Nixon Coalition. So take the same question and tell us about Sophie's trajectory.
We show Nick meeting Sophie at the Dump Nixon Coalition, which, by the way, is exactly where we met. That was the name of the group. And how they fall in love. For Sophie, this was this date. Chapter 5 is called I'm Paying for My Meal, and a story of their first date. It was a really an insight into women, a lot of women like me, who met a guy who didn't know the lingo, was amazed to see a woman paying for her own meal, because that
he hadn't been through consciousness raising, right?
Exactly. It wasn't the way you did things. But what she quickly realizes is that he's somebody who really listens to women, who is fighting pornography all by himself in the lunch room, the break room at the steel mill, the coke oven, who is helping a friend who's in an abusive situation plan her escape, and someone who knows and loves kids. And she realizes that's what really is the heart of being respectful of women and being a feminist, the other stuff she can teach him. So stories in the book go on to show them being married, having two kids, run-ins when you don't have any money, and how to deal with the medical establishment and debt collectors. And then Sophie finding her way into activism for working women, first as a volunteer, and then there's a little money for her to be part-time staff. And so you see her become trained. You see her get her eyes open and learn some really important lessons about organizing, and all of it centering the women who are most impacted by the lousy pay, sexual harassment, racism, homophobia, et cetera, in the workplace. Right. And that continues. You meet people who, like her, get involved and then go on to become leaders. And until toward the end of the book, you see them, her and her colleague, Vanessa, doing sexual harassment training for firefighters in Kansas City.
Right, which I have a question about, of course, and we will get to that. Yeah. Because I know that really happened. But first, there's some wonderful characters in the book. One of my favorites is Vanessa, who is a Black woman who gets organized by Sophie and then becomes a real leader. But the one I wanted to ask you about is Annie. And the reason she really struck a chord with me, because I remember going out in the 1990s to the Raspberry Workers organizing drive and interviewing a woman who was a Mexican immigrant, very little education, who had been involved in helping to organize her fellow raspberry pickers. It was pretty apparent to us that they were going to lose, and they knew it too. But I asked her, I said, so, you know, you've been through a lot. You may get fired if you lose. Is it worth it? And she said to me, absolutely worth it. She said, because it changed my life. Learning how to stand up with my fellow workers has taught me how to stand up for myself and insist on my own dignity at the doctor's office, with teachers, and anywhere I go. And so the story of Annie in your book, who finds the courage first to stand up at work and then to stand up against her abusive husband. Tell us about that insight for you and that kind of transformation that you saw in workers.
It's exactly what you said. It's exactly the inspiration and lesson we wanted to share. The change that happens to people when they find the support, because it's not just some kind of individual courage. It's really that people have your back and you realize you're not alone, and that what's happening to you is not happening only to you, and that you now have the strength to stand up for yourself because you are in this community. And there's a author named Mbolo Mbue who uses the term the deliberately unheard. And that's really who we wanted to lift up. Not that people don't have a voice, it's that they don't have a megaphone. And we wanted to share these stories so that they can be inspiring to others. Annie's story was important in several ways. So she's someone who, because of a stand-up at work, gets the courage to leave her husband. We wanted to show what's that like, you know, that you don't just walk out the door, especially if you don't have money. He later takes the kids and she has to figure out a way to get them back and then escape.
And there's a lot of stories like those or similar things of people figuring out that they have power and that they have a voice in the book. And I think that's what makes it inspiring. We're talking to Ellen Bravo and Larry Miller about their novel, Standing Up, Tales of Struggle. This is the Heartland Labor Forum. Another whole example of inspiration, Larry, was after you switched careers and became a high school teacher, the chapter about your kids researching, or Nick, this is Nick, I shouldn't say Larry, although I know it's, yeah, okay. Nick has his kids start researching the local environment and environmental spill and protesting the CEO of Ashland Oil Company, which is a big oil company. The kind of interdisciplinary problem solving that Nick presents in the class is, to me, teaching at its truly best. Can you talk more about that and that approach to teaching?
As an editor of Rethinking Schools and having been a teacher for 21 years, my goal was to have students actually interact with the reality they were facing outside. Well, in school, but also outside of school. And so we did this unit. Actually, it was a unit on density, because in Milwaukee, the old way of heating your house was through oil tanks buried under the ground, but those aren't used anymore, but they still sit there with residue. And so there was a group here that tracked where all of them were. So we're redoing the amount of density there were in certain communities to these old oil tanks to other communities. And so I raised the issue of environmental racism to my students, and we had discussions about that. You know, their conclusion was, wow, racism can be in a lot of places. You know what I mean? It's not just the KKK or, you know, those sorts of things. So one day I'm sitting in my classroom and these two students come in and they're like, Mr. Miller, you won't believe this. You got to come and look at it. And they had been walking to school very close. It was Custer High School, named after the general. And there's a playground about four blocks away that was also owned by the school district, Custer Playground. They walked down the tracks right next to it and they found oil bubbling up out of the ground. So we went over there, we analyzed it. We got in touch with the Department of Natural Resources. But my goal was, okay, I'm going to help facilitate this and give kids some tools, but I want them to lead this and to be responsible for what they have come to understand and how this is going to be resolved. And it was very successful. The chapter, it really does align with what had happened. They won with getting stuff out in the newspapers. They won with the school board because it was actually on school board property, and they won with the company. Struggles don't always end up like that, but this was pretty incredible, being led by students. And that's something that I've always believed in. Children and young folks are discussed throughout the book. And that was a big component, because activism has to include our children. But then when the kids get to high school, they can actually lead the struggle. And so this is part of what we wanted to show.
When I worked with Larry on writing that chapter, I was, just like you said, really impressed with the interdisciplinary approach that they took.
Uh-huh.
Having, you know, people who were focused on writing skills, people who were focused on math skills, people who were focused on geography and social science, that they were in each of these classes, they were doing this project and really synthesizing it. So it was so interesting to them. It's a whole different way of seeing school and what you do in your classroom.
Yeah, well, it's much more like popular education, really.
Right.
Yeah, which we use a lot, of course, in labor education. But yeah, I think I wish we had more of that kind of teaching in our schools. I think we'd have much better citizens and activists. Absolutely. I want to ask you about feminism. This is a very feminist book in many aspects, and there's so much we could talk about, but we're not going to have the time. But let's bring it up to the present a little bit. I mean, there's fights for women's equality in the workplace. I mean, this isn't the kind of feminism where, you know, anybody wants to be CEO. This is working class feminism about women being able to take care of their families and have a life at work that isn't totally stressed out. And so it seems so much like it's two steps forward and one step backward. I mean, now, as we face Roe versus Wade, have we come full circle? Is there, you know, are we going backwards? And how do you see it in terms of working women?
The way we see this in general, when people are fighting for liberation, is the building power is really important. And we need to understand that the system is rigged and that what is needed is structural systemic change. So we're not surprised. We understand and anticipate that every time we make progress, there'll be pushback. And, you know, there's been a fight to take back the right to control our decision-making about our bodies and our families since the day it passed. So we weren't surprised about this, especially as we saw the way the right wing has attacked democracy and tried to take control of the court and try to limit our ability to make these decisions on our own. What's different, though, is the horror that women are feeling around the country. The idea that somebody would do this to them is politicizing lots of people. Their expectation is, we deserve this. This is who we are. We're not going back. And I think that, as much as anything, is a sign of our progress. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to ask you about the Kansas City firefighters. I remember that case. I had no idea that you were the one who was brought in to actually do the sexual harassment training. Most sexual harassment training that unions have done have primarily been sort of, let's stay out of jail.
Exactly,
you know, like if we get sued, we can say, well, we trained them, it's not our fault.
That's exactly right.
This was something totally different. Can you talk about the methodology a little bit of how you took a group of very mixed firefighters in terms of attitudes, but some who were pretty macho and were harassers? How did you get them to recognize that there was another way to act?
Yeah. So this chapter really encapsulates the key approaches we took in the training. That's why the title has the chapter Firefighters and Feminism. He said, when I saw your application, I didn't even read it. Firefighters, feminism, what do they know? But he said, after you did that presentation, I got it. And basically what I was saying is, if you want this to work, the good news is that the training can make a difference. But the other truth is that you have nearly 800, mostly guys, who are expecting at best to be bored out of their minds and at worst to be screamed at and preached to. So you got to have someone who knows how to talk to men and to union members and how to get through. And that's what we did. So one of the things that we started with was helping people see, because, you know, that description of walking into a room where everybody was sitting with their arms, well, 20 white men, arms crossed tight, and had made a pact that they only two people would talk, and they were the ones who were going to give us a hard time. We caught on right away, and we just said, hey, I'll talk the way I talk then. We can see you're pissed off. What are you pissed off at us for? You don't even know us. And they said, well, if you really know it's just a few guys who are doing this, then what are you punishing us for? If you know that the majority of us aren't harassers, why are you forcing us to take this training? And we said, we're so glad you asked, because you know who they are and you didn't do anything to stop them. And people just fell out of their chairs. You know, it was like a concept they'd never heard of. They thought you either harassed or you didn't. They had no idea that there was such a thing as a bystander who was allowing this to happen and who was, and what they really understood is that it wasn't a case of some poor woman needing help. It was going up to the guy who was doing it and saying, back off. I don't want to work in a place where people treat each other like this. Our lives literally depend on each other. What are you doing?
Yeah.
We need to be unified. And also when they understood that it wasn't about some random off-color joke, that it was about humiliation and control and really debasing people.
Right.
And that wasn't what they wanted to be part of.
So I have time for only one more question, which is really too bad. You two have organized for social justice your entire lives, adult lives anyway. Despite all the victories you had, it looks like this country is facing fascism. Two questions. What kept you going and what makes you think it's still worth it?
What keeps us going always is the joy of seeing people step into power. That moment when they realize that what they're experiencing is not inevitable, it's not normal, and that it can be changed, and that they are the agents of that change, not acting on their own, but acting together with other people. It's been such a privilege and pleasure to be part of that, seeing that over and over again. So when you meet people who have no money and very little time, getting involved because they know that they have no choice. What choice do we have? Of course, we're going to be part of that. And we are inspired by so many struggles today. You know, the Amazon labor union, the teachers in West Virginia and Oklahoma and Arizona. and also struggles in other countries. Mm-hmm. And it makes us realize that the building blocks for what we need exist. And the power of the Black Lives Matter movement, the immigrant rights movement, the LGBTQ movement, we see this determination, and we understand what it means if all those movements can work in concert. The building blocks are there, and we know how. It's having the resources to do it and keeping the people who would stop us from getting in the mix and sabotaging it. So we're proud to be part of that struggle.
Okay, and Larry, what can you add to that?
Ellen pretty much said it.
Okay, well, we're out of time. We've been talking to Larry Miller and Ellen Bravo about their book called Standing Up, Tales of Struggle, which is published by a working class publisher, Hardball Press. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Tune in on the first Thursday of every month at 7 p.m. for Next Step Forward, a program highlighting millennials in the KC Metro that are using their talents, businesses, and activism to educate and uplift their communities. Join us for fresh insights, candid conversations, and interviews that will make you think. If you want to learn, laugh, and be empowered, this is the show for you. Join me, Jasmine Jones, every first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. right here on KKFI.
August 2nd is primary election day in Kansas and Missouri. Kansas citizens can register for this election until July 12th. The Missouri deadline has already passed. Whether you think the people who stormed the Capitol last year, January 6th, are patriots, traitors, or something in between, we suggest you register and vote. This message is a public service of KKFI.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Judy Morgan, retired Missouri State Rep and President Emeritus of the AFT Local 691, and I will be your host for tonight's show. Our guest is Sheldon Weisrau, Vice President of Health Policy for the Missouri Foundation for Health. Before joining the foundation, Sheldon was the Senior Policy Advisor for the Alliance for a Healthy Kansas, a broad-based statewide coalition that worked to expand eligibility for CanCare, the state's Medicaid program. Sheldon earned his bachelor's degree from Cornell University and has a master's degree in health policy and management from the Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health. Welcome, Sheldon. We're pleased to have you as our guest this evening to talk about the important topic of Medicaid expansion.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here, and thank you for that very long, seemed long introduction.
You're welcome. I'm impressed by your degrees and the universities you went to. Okay, so we know that many folks fought really hard to get to where we have it in our state. So can you talk about the fight we went through, how we ended up finally getting Medicaid expansion after really about a 7 or 8 year battle?
Yeah, it was a long battle. So just for some context, Medicaid expansion is part of the Affordable Care Act. Some people know it better as Obamacare. Starting in 2014, states had the option to expand eligibility for their Medicaid programs. Here in Missouri, our income eligibility guidelines were among the lowest in the nation. And so you had to be exceptionally low income to qualify for Medicaid. The Affordable Care Act offered states the opportunity to expand eligibility from whatever the low level it was at to 138% of the poverty level, which, to give you an idea, for an individual, that's about $19,000 a year. For a family of four, that's about $38,000. Most states jumped onto that opportunity because they could see that in addition to providing coverage to millions of additional people, it actually would bring a lot of federal money into those those states. Part of the deal was that the federal government would fund at least 90% of the program in perpetuity. And so most states recognized it as the really beneficial, good option that it was. And in those states that adopted it, they saw huge increases in access to health care. They saw people's health improved. They saw big economic benefits across the state, and not only in the healthcare sector, but in communities and in all aspects of the economy. And so Missouri, unfortunately, like Kansas and a handful of other states, the legislature was resistant to adopting the expansion. Here in Missouri, we have a ballot initiative process. And so the issue was taken to the voters in 2020, and it passed pretty handily, 53-47. And so starting last year, an expanded Medicaid program has been available to folks in Missouri.
And one of the other, I know you talked about the economic benefits of expanding Medicaid in states, but as I recall, Missouri was going to gain quite a few jobs if we expanded Medicaid, not only in the healthcare industry, but in some ancillary industries too.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what you see happening when you expand health coverage for folks, the immediate effect is that you need more people working in the healthcare sector to provide coverage for those folks. And that goes beyond just providers, nurses and doctors. I mean, if you have a clinic or a hospital, you have a lot of other folks that work there, the administrative people, the people that keep the place clean. All of those jobs increase. And then what you see is that because it takes a village, essentially, healthcare impacts not only folks who work in healthcare, but lots of other industries around it that support the healthcare industry. So the example that I always like to use to make it simple for folks is you have more nurses in the hospital, they have to eat lunch. So the restaurants they go out to lunch at also see benefits. And so those benefits flow throughout the economy. And what you see is an increase in jobs, not only in the healthcare sector, but throughout the economy. And there's been ample evidence. It's pretty early in Missouri to start looking at those numbers, but Medicaid expansion has been around for nearly a decade in most of the country. And there is just really robust evidence of the economic and job creation benefits of the program across the country.
Well, I remember I liked a quote that Governor Nixon used to say. He said Medicaid expansion is the right thing to do and it's a smart thing to do. And
I really
agreed with that because I believe people should have health care and that it also benefits the whole economic structure of our society too. So
yeah, absolutely. And I think it's important to realize that because obviously the immediate impact is there are a lot of people who don't have coverage and access to healthcare, they gain that. But the benefits that come beyond that are really wide ranging. And that's why it was so important that Missouri get healthcare, get Medicaid expansion passed. And that's why in a handful of states that are still refusing it, most of them in the Deep South and a handful in the Midwest, it's almost an act of self-harm by a state legislature to not adopt the program. And what we see is state legislatures, for ideological reasons, not doing something that is beneficial for their constituents. And it's really a shame.
Right. Well, you have a lot of experience with getting health care in rural Missouri, and not just rural Missouri, but like you say, you worked in Kansas prior to that. So how does Medicaid expansion help Missourians in general? And in particular, talk about the rural communities and the underserved communities, because I know you've got a lot of experience in that too.
Sure. It's for rural communities, what you have to understand is it's been a struggle to maintain access to healthcare for generations. It's hard to get adequate workforce. There's just not enough resources to provide all the services that people need. That said, a lot of communities are able to support hospitals. They're small hospitals. They may provide just a limited set of services compared to their larger colleagues in urban areas, but they're out there and they're providing services. They're creating jobs in communities. They're serving as the economic engines of their communities. What we've seen in the last 10 years or so is an epidemic of closures of rural hospitals. And it's just, they're falling victim to just the difficult economics of running a resource intensive operation in a small community that doesn't have a lot of resources. Medicaid expansion provides a direct infusion of additional revenue into rural hospitals. And what we've seen is that hospitals are much more likely to survive in states that have Medicaid expansion than in states that don't. And so, unfortunately, in Missouri, expansion came too late for the hospitals that closed before that, but it is going to really help moving forward in keeping some of those rural hospitals alive. Again, this has been extensively studied. Medicaid expansion decreases the risk of closure by more than six times. And so it makes an enormous difference for rural communities. You also mentioned other underserved communities. And by underserved communities, that's a catch-all phrase for communities that may have difficulty for one reason or another in accessing healthcare. And for those communities as well, which may be made up of low-income people, they're disproportionately people of color. Those folks gaining health insurance and being able to get healthcare services just makes a tremendous difference, and also supports the providers who provide care in those communities, and then more broadly supports the other businesses that work in those communities.
Right. Tonight on the Heartland Labor Forum, we're talking to Sheldon Weisbrod, Vice President of Health Policy for the Missouri Foundation for Health, and we're talking about Medicaid expansion in Missouri. In the last legislative session, the Republicans really took a full frontal attack on Medicaid expansion. As you said, the legislature just stubbornly refused to pass it for quite a few years. So a group of folks decided to take it to the ballot box. We have a great initiative petition process in Missouri where we can take things directly to the voters, and the voters approved it, like you said, by about 53%. So is the Republicans tried a number of ways to stop it in the legislature. Talk about that.
Sure. So first, I just want to push back a little. It certainly was not all Republicans. It was the more conservative wing of the Republican Party in Missouri that tried to essentially put expansion back on the ballot in what I would call a misleading way. And so the first thing that would have shown up on the ballot would have been a provision that prohibited people from out of state from accessing the Missouri Medicaid program. And you had to read farther down to get to where you actually got to the part about Medicaid expansion. And what the bill would have done is it would have subjected each individual piece of Medicaid to the budget appropriations process. And so if you go back to the court case that eventually got us Medicaid in Kansas, the court ruled that if the state is going to fund Medicaid, it must fund all the populations that are eligible for Medicaid. What this ballot initiative would have done is would have enabled the state legislature to say, okay, we will fund Medicaid for children, but we won't fund Medicaid for people in the expansion group. We'll fund Medicaid for pregnant women, but we won't fund Medicaid for people with disabilities. And I think thanks to the efforts of some moderate Republicans in the legislature and the Democrats in the legislature and those folks who support the Medicaid program, that effort was turned back and we won't be seeing that. I don't think we've seen the end of those efforts. I think we're likely to see opponents of Medicaid expansion coming back year after year and trying to put up roadblocks and barriers, which is really unfortunate because, like I said, the evidence of its benefits is just simply overwhelming. To continue to go back, it takes, I mean, you remember as a legislator, your time is limited. There's only so many things you can focus on, and having to devote time to things that would actively harm the folks in the state of Missouri is just really unfortunate.
When you said about the out-of-state, that out-of-state residents could not get Medicaid expansion was on the ballot. I mean, you're actually living out-of-state. You don't qualify for Medicaid in Missouri, right?
Yeah, it's very complicated. There are some services in Missouri because Missouri has centers of excellence, particularly for children's hospitals, that occasionally there are kids who live in other states that might be eligible. It's a very minor thing, and it actually has been taken care of administratively. But that ballot language was put in my opinion, to mislead folks as to what the ballot, that ballot initiative would have been all about, because the issue of out of state people getting Missouri Medicaid is not really a problem.
Right. And if the legislator had to appropriate it every year, I mean, they could have decided whether to appropriate the money for Medicaid expansion or not, if they'd gotten through this amendment, correct?
That's correct. And that would have been how it would have been an attack on Medicaid expansion, right? Because we would have seen the legislature come back year after year. And again, this is not universal amongst all legislators, but some would have tried to stop funding the expansion. But I think it's also important for folks to understand that the language wasn't specific to expansion. The language gave the legislature the authority to fund or not fund any of the populations that are eligible for Medicaid. And so we could have been talking about kids. We could have been talking about low-income mothers. We could have been talking about pregnant women. We could have been talking about people with disabilities. Every one of those populations would have been subject to the appropriations process. And so I think we focus on expansion because that's the target that those legislators were shooting at, but the ultimate impact could have been much broader.
Oh gosh, I didn't even know that. Thank you for letting me know. Let's talk about, just so our listeners know, what are the qualifications for getting Medicaid being in Medicaid? Right now, Medicaid had covered children, pregnant women, disabilities, but it didn't cover adults, basically, or unless they had a disability or they were pregnant. And the Medicaid expansion actually expanded that population. So talk about who qualifies under that.
Sure. So previously, Medicaid in Missouri covered, as you mentioned, the disabled population. We do a pretty good job of covering kids. And it covered pregnant women during the course of their pregnancy. And it covered parents, but you had to be very low income. So if you were not a parent, you are not eligible for Medicaid at all, regardless of your income. If you were a parent, you had to have a household income of below about 20% of the federal poverty level. So just to give you a sense that for a family of three, like a mom and two kids, which is a pretty typical family, that'd be under about $4,700 a year to be eligible for Medicaid. So it was nearly impossible to qualify. Anybody who was working, even a very part-time job, would be making too much money to qualify for Medicaid. What expansion did was, as I said earlier, expand eligibility up to 138% of the federal poverty level. So that's about $19,000 for an individual, about $32,000 for a family of three, $38,000 for a family of four. So what we're doing is we've made more than 200,000 additional people eligible for the Medicaid program. Most of them people who are low income parents who are working, but we're just making too much money to be able to qualify under our really low limits before.
So we have heard about Medicaid lagging enrollment, and we're getting really short on time. I'm sorry, because this is such a good topic. I think there's been some trouble with people getting on it if they're part of the expanded population. Can you just talk real briefly about that?
Yeah, the state of Missouri through the Department of Social Services is having a real struggle in handling the volume of folks who are applying for Medicaid. They're having a staffing shortage, so that's adding to that. They have recently been working with the federal government to get some expanded authorities that should help get people enrolled faster. But at the current time, a lot of people are waiting a very long time after they apply to be enrolled in Medicaid. And I know that the federal government who oversees that process is working with the state to try to get them into compliance with federal law. And if they can't within the next few months, there's probably going to be some plans that are imposed on the state to try to get them into compliance. So I think it's unfortunate because we want to really encourage people to apply for the program and not get discouraged if it takes a long time. So as they go through the process, they should not apply multiple times because that actually slows the process down, but they should be applying and they can be patient. And one good thing is that if someone applies, and even if it takes a few months for them to be determined eligible, any services they received during the time they were waiting mm-hmm. will be backdated and covered by the Medicaid program. So I would encourage folks who are pretty sure they're eligible to apply for the program, to seek out the services they need. Don't stay out of the healthcare system because you're afraid of the costs. And eventually, if the state gets its act in gear, the coverage will catch up with the people. But I could certainly understand folks who are really reluctant to get healthcare services if they're not certain they're going to be paid for.
So what do they do? Do they go to a website? Is there a phone number?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ways people can do it. You can go to the Missouri Department of Social Services website, which is mydss.mo.gov, and apply online. Maybe an easier way to do it is there's a website, covermissouri.org, that if folks look at that, it will give them access to a number of assisters in their area who can sit down with them and help them go through that enrollment process. Because it's not necessarily a simple process. And so sitting down with someone who understands how it works and can walk you through is very helpful.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Sheldon Weisgrau, for being on our show tonight, Vice President of Health Policy for the Missouri Foundation for Health. We really appreciated the updates on Medicaid expansion and appreciate your service in these efforts. Thank you.
Thank you. Been my pleasure.
Now working in this mill is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Everybody tells me that they're sticklers for safety. I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die.
Hello, this is Mary Aereo for Safety First. First, Labor Department announces alliance with the Kansas City Electrical Apprenticeship and Training Committee from the OSHA News release for June 13th. Recognizing the need for developing safe electrical work practices at the start of a career, the Kansas City Electrical Joint Apprenticeship and Training Committee, a training apprenticeship program for electricians, has signed an alliance with the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA offices in Kansas City, Missouri, and Wichita, Kansas. The International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Chapter 124, and the National Electrical Contractors Association are also joining the alliance. Partnering with the Electrical Apprenticeship Program to teach safety standards on day one of an individual's career will help develop lifetime safety habits that prevent workplace injuries, said OSHA Acting Regional Administrator Stephen Kaplan in Kansas City. Local OSHA offices have made electrical safety education a priority since last fall 2021, following the fatal electrocution of four workers in Kansas and Missouri in 5 months. Learn more about OSHA resources on electrical safety at www.osha.gov/electrical. Next, the Mine Safety and Health Administration targets the new black lung from www.ehstoday.com for July 6th. The Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration, MSHA, has launched an enforcement initiative targeting the exposure of coal miners to respirable crystalline silica, which, when added to coal dust, creates a more deadly form of the black lung disease that strikes its victims down more quickly than the older form of the illness. Materials like sand, stone, concrete, and mortar contain crystalline silica. Respirable crystalline silica, minute particles at least 100 times smaller than ordinary beach sand, become airborne during cutting, sawing, grinding, drilling, and crushing stone and rock. That is why OSHA already has in place and enforces extensive regulations dealing with the production of and manufacturing processes using silica. MSHA, however, has yet to issue new regulations in regard to silica, although it has announced that one will be coming this fall. Without proper protection and engineering controls, miners can be exposed to dangerous levels of crystalline silica particles. The relatively new version of black lung disease came into prominence late in the last decade, and it has been observed to progress more quickly than the older version, resulting in some coal miners dying from it in their 20s.
The widespread addition of silica to coal dust is believed to have occurred because seams of almost pure coal have been disappearing, resulting in the mining of more coal mixed with rock. Finally, what companies need to know about OSHA's new heat illness program, from OHSonline.com for June 30th. Those of you who work in the heat might know that 18 of the last 19 summers have been the hottest on record. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that between 2015 and 2019, environmental heat cases resulted in an average of 35 fatalities per year and an average of 2,700 cases that resulted in days away from work. However, the total number of heat-related fatalities may be underreported. The cause of death is often listed as a heart attack, when the actual cause or aggravating case may have been exposure to heat-related hazards. Heat-related illnesses range from heat cramps to heat stroke, which can potentially lead to death. To protect workers from heat-related illnesses and injuries, OSHA announced a new National Emphasis Program, NEP, on April 12th. The NEP consists of targeted inspections, outreach, and compliance assistance. OSHA is also developing a heat exposure standard. Here are a few scenarios where OSHA could and would likely inspect for heat stress. Scenario 1, facility has a reportable injury such as a heart attack, hospitalization, and the heat index was above 80 degrees on the day of the incident. Or Scenario 2, employee complaint to OSHA about unsafe work conditions related to heat. The best defense for your company has against heat illness is to mitigate it before it happens. A good place to start is the OSHA Heat Safety app at www.osha.gov/heat. You should even consider creating your own heat illness checklist to ensure you're taking all the appropriate measures needed to protect workers, which would include adequate access to water and shade, what to do in emergencies, and worker training. This is Mary Ariel for Safety First.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. You can find our calendar on our Facebook page. Please go there, like us, and you'll see our upcoming shows and various news things we post. Vote no on Amendment 2 rally Sunday, July 10th, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Village West Parallel Parkway entrance. Bring signs. Kansas, ACLU, and Loudlight are having a Know Your Voting Rights training this coming Sunday evening at 7 p.m. It's online. Register at loudlight.org/events. And Saturday, July 16th, is the Wyandotte County Democratic Breakfast. More on that next week. Tune in next week for our show. It is a pregnant HLF volunteer investigates maternity leave, and we'll profile the new AFL-CIO leadership. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Stephen Hill, with assistance from Lincoln Dreyer. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special. It's Jasmine Jones hosting Next Step Forward.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss. And you can talk back to us, too. Send us your feedback, your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming ones, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on this show are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening at 6 or to our rebroadcast Friday mornings at 5 right here, 90.1 FM KKFI.
We still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class, and that's the place to be. He said if I were Frank Sinatra, I'd pull strings. And through political bull, you'd be on top of the glorified garbage pile with all of their plastic smiles. You'd be with all the self-appointed kings and queens, with all their power and wealth and the material. good enough for me.
That's the place to be.